Welcome. This is the Committee on Health, Human Services, and Housing. It's Monday, March 3rd. We have a very intense agenda, so I will repeat what I've said before, that we hope that that everyone knows that we are expecting that people will work within the time frame that has been established for the legislation that you're presenting, that your presenters are prepared and practiced to stay within their time frame, because we will be holding to that time frame. And we certainly expect that we should be able to get through this agenda in our time frame. We will be meeting again this evening at, what time is it, 6 p.m. in this room to continue with this evening's agenda. So I will be repeating this. If you're here for the first time and you represent groups who will be coming in front of this committee, please hear me, that I expect that you train your presenters to speak within a certain time frame. Practice with them ahead of time so that we can stay on time in this very short session. And with that, we'll begin with Senate File 1904. Senator Jensen, welcome to the table. Please introduce yourself and your testifiers on the optometrist licensing provisions and modifications.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Sorry. Senate File 1904 is the result of work performed by the Board of Optometry. They've been working for the past 5 years to bring all optometrists to the same educational level. This bill removes unnecessary implementation language. It also places the fees in statute and updates their disciplinary and complaint process to follow the Board of Medical Practice. With that, I'll turn it over now to Randy Snyder, who's the Executive Director of the Board of Optometry.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Randy Snyder, the Executive Director. The board is comprised of 7 board members, 5 of which are licensed optometrists from Redwood Falls, Northfield, Virginia, Dr. Sipola, Owatonna, Bloomington, and 2 public members from Apple Valley and Woodbury. And as Senator Jensen said, they've spent the last year working on this legislation. We believe it is clean. We have worked with the provider associations. There is no known opposition. And with that, I will stop my testimony and turn it over for the 3.5 minutes to Dr. Sipola.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Don Sipola. I'm an optometrist practicing in Virginia and in Duluth on the Iron Range. I'm also a city councilor in Virginia, so I respect and understand the public service and responsibilities that you have, that when I sit on your side of the table and hear testimony in the public, I appreciate that. The major portion of this bill is essentially a housekeeping initiated by our board representative from the Attorney General's office. It was recommended, instead of revising or tweaking outdated and ineffective language, the Board of Optometry would merely adopt the already statutorily approved language for the Board of Medical Practice, with only occupational definitions deleted or inserted into this proposed language. The result is this legislation would match the Board of Medical Practice with regard to already existing standards related to grounds for disciplinary action, reporting requirements, immunity, cooperation, and disciplinary measurements. This reflects the effort by the Attorney General's office to make consistent practice standards across all boards. The second portion of this bill removes terminology and language that no longer applies to any licensed optometrist in Minnesota. It is also a housekeeping measure, as implementation of contemporary practice standards over the last 20 years is now complete statewide. It ensures all current and new licensees are qualified at the highest level. The removal of these interim requirements listed in statute eliminates confusion to the public, the applicants for licensure, and the meaningless busy work and needless cost to the Board of Optometry. Lastly, we are asking that board fees be transferred from rules and placed in statutes. Fees for the Minnesota Board of Optometry have not increased over the last 27 years. Minnesota's fees are currently in the lowest 25 percentile in comparison to similar fees assessed by other states. The board believes they have demonstrated prudent stewardship of their resources over these 27 years. Therefore, the board is requesting that fees be transferred from rule to statute as a not-to-exceed amount. This reflects a growing board practice to manage your fund balances at the board level in consultation with key stakeholders and not place this burden on the legislature each time. The board does not wish to increase its present fees in this session, but does seek statutory authority, as other boards have, to do so if warranted. Ultimately, the legislature and the governor maintain control over final spending within the biennial budget process, so adequate oversight is maintained. In summary, we know of no opposition and believe this is good public policy to, one, update the Minnesota Board of Optometry to modern national practice standards regarding discipline, two, eliminate outdated and archaic language that no longer is applicable and reduce cost, and three, provide reasonable flexibility in regulating board fees. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We will stand for any questions that you may have.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. And thank you for your service as well on a city council.
Thank you.
Close to the people and close to the complaints in the neighborhood restaurants. I know. I've been there. So thank you very much, Dr. Cipolla. Say, I was just wondering if you have an author's amendment that you'd like to offer at this time. It's the A2 amendment.
Yes.
Senator Jensen offers the A2 amendment. It's an author's amendment. Are there any questions or discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment passes. Thank you, Senator Jensen. Are there any others who would like to make comments or testify on this bill at this time? I want to note that there is a quorum, so our passing of the amendment passed. All right. Any questions for our testifiers? Seeing none. Oh, excuse me. Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one question on page 7, lines 6 through 8. If you could just tell me a little bit about that. The burden of proof is on the applicant to proactively demonstrate versus the other way around. How do they demonstrate qualifications and such in this language? What does that mean they have to do?
Senator, on my
would you repeat
seven,
your name, please?
Dr. Cipolla, thank you, Madam Chair. On my page 7, they're all listed as number 7. Did you say line 6 or subdivision 6?
Senator Nino?
On page 7, line 7.6 through 7.8.
7.6, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, Senator Nino, this is just boilerplate language that we got from the Board of Medical Practice, to be quite honest. So it is currently statutorily approved for the Board of Medical Practice. I'm not so sure the detail behind that. The reality would be is that we've never had a complaint that's risen to this level. So it is just simple language that's been placed in there. I really couldn't respond to your question, but I will try to get information back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Senator Nino, did you want to follow up, or that's okay? Seeing no further questions, all those in favor of Senate File 190. Senator Nelson.
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. I did have a question. I just didn't know if there were any other testifiers.
No, there were no.
I wanted
more,
to hear
no
all
further
the testifiers.
Testifiers.
But my question is just kind of a simple one. Has to do with page 4, line 30 to 34. And I'm just curious, I know we've done this in many industries, and so maybe this is just being consistent, but with the concerns that we have about drugs and people getting them who shouldn't and such, my question is, what's the rationale for removing the certificate that must be posted that says an optometrist can dispense or prescribe particular drugs? I'm just curious about why we're removing that piece from the current law.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Nelson.
Dr. Cipolla.
Dr. Cipolla, I'm sorry. Yes. You'll see the words in the second and 4.33, the words topical ocular drugs. That was a legislative definition of a limited use of three medications placed in 1983. There is no one that is limited to that. All licensed optometrists have full prescribing capability There are no different levels or different practice scopes. They're all exactly the same. All graduates have well beyond this. This was 1983, and back in my era, basically, we've all either up our education or retired, but there's nobody left.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any further questions? Seeing none, Senator Marty, would you be willing to move that Senate File 1904 be recommended to pass, referred to Judiciary, and this bill will also be considered for inclusion in the omnibus bill as amended? Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Passes. Thank you very much, Senator Jensen. The next hearing is on Senate File 1824. Senator Carlson, is he here? Ready? If not, we can move. I don't think he's here. I can't see an indication over here. So we can now move to Senate File 1799, Senator Wicklund, Licensed Professional Clinical Counselors Licensing Provision Modifications. Senator Wicklund, would you mind holding? I see Senator Carlson has come in, and we can go back to that agenda item since he has other committees that he needs to be in. So, Senator Carlson, please come forward. We will now move to Senate File 1824, orthotics, prosthetics, and et cetera. Thank you. Welcome, Senator Carlson. Please, if you have an amendment, would you like to offer that right away, or how would you like to proceed? And then, as you do your testimony, would you introduce your testifiers as well?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I have the A1 amendment, if we could get someone to move that.
There's an author's amendment, A1 amendment. It should be included in your materials. Would you like to just simply describe what the A1 amendment is? Is it an author's amendment or a delete all? It's a delete all amendment, apparently.
It's a delete all, and make some corrections on things that have come up since this was originally introduced. And to be honest with you, I don't have all of the minor detail changes, but this is essentially the bill as it should have been.
Thank you. Since it's a delete all amendment, not an author's amendment, I think we will have Senator Nienau, are you willing to offer the delete all amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Passes. Sorry, Senator, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate File 1824 is a bill for pronunciation exercise here to license orthotists, prosthetists, and
Petterthix, and other
professionals who apply custom body bracing and artificial limbs to individuals. And it's primarily to set up an advisory council whose task it is to advise the Board of Podiatric Medicine about the enforcement of the standards in statute review applications. License or qualifications are placed into statute in order to receive a license. And just a little background, until January 2016, there will be a transition period by which certain current practitioners may apply and receive a license without meeting all of the qualifications. The bill sets the grounds for disciplinary action and gives the board authority to investigate complaints. Unlicensed practice would be prohibited under this bill and would be a misdemeanor. Finally, the bill establishes fees for licensure process. And with me, I have a testifier, Mr. Rick Miller, who is a trainer, and I will let him introduce himself as to his background. But he will testify for the bill.
Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of this committee. Thank you, Senator Carlson, for the author of this important bill. Just as brief introduction to myself, I was born right here in St. Paul, grew up in Roseville. I've been a lifetime resident of the state of Minnesota. Myself and my children are all Minnesota educated, and I even love Minnesota winter. That said, we are here to consider the merits of passing Senate File 1824, a bill to license orthotists, prosthetists, and pedorthists. I've said that more often than you have. In the state of Minnesota. For two-thirds of my life, I've had the privilege of a career in the field. I thoroughly enjoy orthotics and prosthetics. We in the field tend to refer to it as O&P, and I invite you to shorten that category to describe it as such. For those of you who may be less familiar with O&P, it is all about helping people take steps forward in their lives. The profession is a unique blend of healthcare and material science, requiring studies of medical and engineering topics to enable its practitioners to apply external devices to the body to improve function. Orthoses, or external braces, and prostheses, or artificial limbs, are provided by orthotists and prosthetists to evaluate the medical needs of the patient, mold or measure the patient, design and fabricate a custom orthosis or prosthesis, fit the patient, and then continue to optimize the fit through follow-up care. As a part of the rehabilitation team with other allied health professionals, orthotists and prosthetists provide a full spectrum of medically necessary services and physician-prescribed devices. The end result can vastly enhance the quality of life for persons with limb absence or help to increase the capabilities of those with weakness or deformation of the limbs and spine. These are medical interventions with truly amazing outcomes. Please consider the following examples. When the 35W bridge collapsed, the result was injuries, including many spinal injuries. Orthotists were called on to help make plastic body jackets to aid in their recovery. It's very common that patients who undergo orthopedic surgery are encouraged to return to activity as soon as possible. Orthotists routinely treat these patients with post-op orthoses or braces, which help the individuals to return promptly to their daily activities. And just as an aside, I won't mention any names, but recently a high-ranking Minnesota public official who had hip surgery in Rochester, I think you know who I'm talking about, interacted with a professional orthotist in Rochester for the fitting of his brace. On a more serious note, when injured war veterans return from combat missing one or more limbs, they are looking for ways to reclaim their life. Prosthetists can offer the skills and tools to help make that happen. These amazing results happen every day all across Minnesota, and indeed it is happening as we sit here today. My career in orthotics and prosthetics began 40 years ago, enrolling in a program at 916 AVTI, which is now Century College in White Bear Lake. The state of Minnesota has generously and wisely supported the educational programs in orthotics and prosthetics at Century College since 1974. I want to take this opportunity to say thank you on behalf of all the graduates of these programs over the 40 years, and a very special thank you on behalf of the thousands, literally tens of thousands of patients that graduates of those programs have treated over the years. The value of O&P education has been further recognized nationally with an $11 million HOPE grant, which was awarded to the profession to enhance O&P technician programs. The high distinction of managing that endowment has been entrusted to the officials of Century College, White Bear Lake. Congratulations. I serve on the board of directors of the American Academy of Orthotists and Prosthetists. This weekend, I just returned from our annual meeting and scientific symposium in Chicago. I can report that Minnesota was well represented. Michelle Hall is the current president of the Academy. Michelle hails from Minnesota, works just around the corner from the Capitol down at Gillette Children's Hospital. Carl Caspers is a prominent Minnesota practitioner who received a Lifetime Achievement Award at this meeting for his inventions and commitment to the O&P field. Also receiving recognition was Dr. Kenton Kaufman, Ph.D., a Rochester Mayo Clinic researcher, for his state-of-the-art contributions to the field. Nationally and internationally, Minnesota received acknowledgement all this year and prior as leading sources of the high-quality practitioners in the O&P field. It is time for the state of Minnesota to join Iowa and 14 other states with OMP licensure bills. Minnesota can take this step and build on the commitment to education that it has already made in this field. Ultimately, you are casting your vote in favor of this bill to take steps to provide an increased level of consumer protection, defining the minimum qualifications of care providers. Although practitioner credentialing and facility accreditation are ways of defining standards to ensure quality care and quality professionals, they are entirely voluntary measures. State licensure reinforces and requires these measures to establish the professional qualifications for delivery of care. Through licensure and by requiring minimum standards of education and experience, Minnesota can remain as a top-tier provider of orthotic and prosthetic services in the nation. It would be shocking to me if this legislature would stumble and choose to continue to leave Minnesota consumers at risk. The status quo of not establishing minimum qualifications to provide care in the field of OMP is simply unacceptable. It's a fact that OMP practitioners are found living in communities in Minnesota from Alexandria to Zumbrota. In facilities located from Hibbing to Mankato, there are orthotists and prosthetists at this very moment helping patients to take their next steps. Over at Gillette and Shriners Children's Hospitals, orthotists and prosthetists may be helping children to take their very first steps fitted with expertly crafted orthotic and prosthetic devices. The state of Minnesota has much to be proud of by taking the steps it has to support OMP education. Help us as a profession to take our next step. Licensure can give patients the confidence in our abilities to enhance their ability. Licensure is the best step to rightly identify Minnesota OMP practitioners in the ranks at the forefront of our field. Minnesotans are counting on us to get this right. Thank you for your attention, and thank you for taking the right step at the right time in support of Senate File 1824.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Are there others who would like to testify in favor of the bill? Did you have other testifiers, Senator Carlson? Not at this time. Okay, we have some others who have asked to make comment on the bill. Unless there's some questions right now for Mr. Miller, we will begin with Sarah Anderson. And Alan Newman and Mike Bailey have also asked to testify. And if you would please come forward, because we're trying to be, you know, careful with our time. Mr. Miller, could you step back at this time and allow for someone else to approach the table? It would be Mr. Newman. Thank you. Would you introduce yourself, Ms. Anderson?
Yes, my name is Sarah Anderson. I'm the Vice President of Sales and Third-Party Services for Key Medical Supply. I am also a certified mastectomy fitter and a certified compression garment fitter. Our organization employs a number of certified fitters that would be required to go for licensure under this bill. While we do not oppose licensure for the complex and customized orthotic and prosthetic devices that were discussed in our predecessor's testimony, we do ask that the legislature consider the scope and depth of more of the common over-the-counter prefabricated devices that our organization and organizations like us currently provide to Minnesotans. We believe that the requirements are duplicative of the requirements that exist today of accreditation and the standards set by Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to receive reimbursement, as well as the Minnesota Medicaid program, which requires us to be certified, as I mentioned, go through the same education programs that exist and or that are required by the licensure bill, and also to pay for ongoing maintenance of accreditation. We believe that as it exists, or as it is written, this bill would constitute a restraint of trade for businesses currently practicing and currently providing products to Minnesotans, and that it would result in access restrictions to Minnesota recipients as well. And just to give you an example of, as I mentioned, I am a certified fitter for mastectomy products, and I wanted to give you an example of the products that and the care that we help to provide. First of all, as mentioned in the bill, it requires, I want to clarify, that as a certified fitter, we do not design treatment plans, as is one of the elements of in the definition of a certified fitter in the bill. We follow the prescriptions ordered by physicians to help women, after having undergone a mastectomy, restore their body image, their self-esteem through a mastectomy prosthetic. This is a prosthetic bra with a prosthetic form in it. We help the woman find the shape that best matches her former breast or her existing alternate breast, and we help them size and fit their bra. We help them understand how to care for their product and how to care for their garments. That is the scope of what we do. If someone presents with skin conditions or looks to be beyond what we are capable of managing, because we are not care providers, we refer them back to their licensed healthcare professionals. Establishing licensure, we believe, beyond what is currently required by CMS, by the Minnesota Medicaid program, would be a restriction on our ability to continue to care for the patients that we have. We ask that Minnesota, if you continue to consider this, take the steps that Virginia did in 2009, which is to study the scope of the licensure requirement, its economic impact on businesses, its need for establishing a scope of practice, again, on these lower, more common, off-the-shelf and prefabricated devices. In that study, which is a 90-page study, I have a copy of it with me, and I can certainly provide the committee with a reference. It was determined by the Virginia Department of Health Professionals that while licensure was necessity for custom fabricated orthotics and prosthetics, it did not rise to the economic impact necessary for over-the-counter, off-the-shelf, and prefabricated devices. With that, I conclude my testimony, and I thank you for your time.
And I thank you for your staying focused and presenting your critical messages, Ms. Anderson. And now, Mr. Newman. Ms.
Madam
Anderson,
Chair,
would you be willing to give the seat to Mr. Bailey?
Absolutely.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Al Newman. A little background, I'm a licensed respiratory therapist. I currently sit on the Respiratory Council, the Medical Board of Pharmacy, and I understand licensure. We've gone through this process. A lot of times when people develop these, they come from a hospitalist point of view, and they don't consider the durable medical equipment world and what we do in the home. And so we work through this process. Currently, I own a durable medical equipment company. We do focus in respiratory, but we also do shoes, diabetic shoes. Dr. Comfort, they're the most comfortable shoes on the market. The manufacturers will not let us provide them unless we have certifications of training. And that's an annual certification. We're also inspected by joint commissions or accreditation companies. I think I pay about $6,000 a year to stay accredited. And the last inspection, we were thoroughly inspected with our diabetic shoe process. We have policy and procedures in place, and again, which limits our scope of practice. Somebody comes in with ulcers, any kind of deformities, I mean, that's beyond our scope of practice. Typically, what we do is preventive medicine. We have physicians and licensed medical practitioners send us customers for special, they need comfortable shoes that they don't have to break in. So this is just a mold set, which we take a mold of their feet. We send it to the manufacturer. They send us inserts that are built specifically to conform with their feet to help prevent ulcers and long-term problems with their feet. That is about the scope of our practice with diabetic shoes. A lot of people just come in and buy them because they're so dang comfortable. This is what we got to do for billing. This is the billing paperwork we complete. So, again, we do an analysis. We document the condition of the patient's foot. We do a 30-day follow-up once we fit them with the product. And this bill would greatly limit our ability to do this. 250 hours of training under a certified trainer. Well, we don't have institutes that we work under. We get the training from the manufacturers, and, again,
with our accreditation. They thoroughly look at our policies and procedures, and I would never contend to fit somebody with a special shoe that needs some kind of deformity or they need a shoe on a prosthetic leg. We would never do that. That's beyond our scope of practice. So thank you, Madam Chairman and committee members.
Thank you, Mr. Newman. Mr. Bailey.
Madam Chair, my name is Mike Bailey. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Handy Medical Supply. And I want to, in this bill, it requires licensures for the distribution of compression therapy stockings. In the bill itself, on page 3.29, it has a definition for something called off-the-shelf devices. And it says a prefabricated device sized or modified for the use by the patient pursuant to a prescription which does not require substantial clinical judgment and or alteration for use. And that's exactly what we're doing. We're following the orders that are written by a physician. The team members at Handy Medical Supply and other durable medical equipment companies are certified by the manufacturers to fit these customers. In addition to that, we're accredited by the, in Handy's case, we're accredited by the Joint Commission. The Joint Commission also, for the record, is the accrediting body over the Mayo Clinic, the Cleveland Clinic, and John Hopkins Medicine, three of perhaps the most storied healthcare organizations in the United States. To suggest that that accreditation process, which is not voluntary, not a good measure of how a company is engaging in this activity, I think, is a distortion of the truth. For requiring licensure on top of the certification process and the accrediting process adds a layer of expense to this business model that's unnecessary and will reduce access to those who require these products. The increased expense will be recognized by the payer of these products as well as the copay paid for the transaction by the patient. The Affordable Care Act, which I believe is the healthcare trend in this nation, is driving towards a lower cost alternative with greater access. 1824 does not offer Minnesota the same vision. Custom prosthetic devices and off-the-shelf devices, in particular compression garments, are distinctly different products that do require different levels of clinical experience. In 1824, we commingle these products and potentially limit both providers and trade for these very important products. And with that, I conclude, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bailey. Senator Nelson, are there others that you know of that wish to testify, or is there anyone in the audience yet seeking to testify? I see someone nodding their head. So I would ask, Mr. Newman, would you provide a space for the testifier? Please approach and give us your name and provide your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Susan Stout. I'm the president and CEO of the Amputee Coalition of America. We are the national consumer organization representing people with limb loss. It is our position in support of this bill that this licensure is very much needed. I know that there are credentials that people can seek short of licensure, but what licensure adds to the protection for the consumer is the ability for the consumer to file a complaint if there's a problem, to have that complaint investigated by the licensing body, and for the licensing body then to intervene. And that is a very important add-on feature of a licensure. We support the bill as it is. We also understand this is a very important piece of legislation. And if exceptions need to be made down the line for the some of the folks that have testified, we don't have an objection to that. But we wanted to impress upon you the importance of moving this legislation forward this year so that consumers can get the kind of protection they need. The legislation has passed in a number of other states. We have not seen a lack of access to care in those states, And in fact, we believe that the protection for the consumer has improved the environment in those states, and we hope that Minnesota would join that group.
Ms. Stout, may I ask you, I appreciate your testimony in support, but I also heard you say that you were hearing the testifiers here articulate some instances where exemptions may need to be articulated in the language. Could you summarize what you heard about that you would be willing to work on?
I think, Madam Chair, members, I think that the testimony on behalf of those who were fitting prosthetics for mastectomy, that particular set of testimony is very compelling, and I believe that an exception in that area would be very much in order. To be honest with you, I need a little time to think about the shoes situation, but for certain, the mastectomy fitter would be, a logical exemption.
And may I further ask you, Ms. Stout, there were some examples of over-the-counter type sales of products that people can purchase that would be restricted under this piece of legislation, as I understood it. Could you respond or react to what people are accustomed to be able to purchase without having to go through a complicated medical process?
Certainly, Madam Chair. Members, our interest is mainly in those products that are custom fitted for the patient. So for those sort of over-the-shelf kind of items that are not custom fitted, we would not have any objection to creating exemptions there. Our main concern is in the area of prosthetics and custom-fitted orthotics.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, maybe it's for Senator Carlson. I hear what Ms. Stout is saying and agree with you about the importance of some of these things, but again, I'm not sure if it's custom fitted, because a lot of these products, I would assume, like the foot arch supports and mastectomy prosthesis and so on, all of them. I mean, a lot of those are over-the-counter products. They may be custom fitted to the person, but I'm not sure where the branch is, but it seems to me that some of these things are much more intrusive to the person, and some of them, I keep thinking compression sleeves, I'm not sure where it is, and maybe missed out. You can stay there. I'm just kind of curious. I think there are some good things in the bill, but I think it's overbroad in some of those areas, and I'm just curious, because I don't think we should pass it and then come back and, well, we didn't mean to include this group and that group. I think we should be fixing it now. But.
Is that a question for Ms. Stout?
Either one, Mr.
Manager. Or Senator Carlson. I think the indication is there is a desire to tighten or clarify more specifically what it is that needs to be included here and separated so that we don't have to come back and fix the bill later because we overreached.
Madam Chair, from a consumer perspective, we wouldn't have an objection to that. I think that probably the experts in the field would be better able to figure out where to draw the line exactly in the language. I don't feel comfortable doing that. But from, the consumer organization perspective, we just want to make sure this moves forward.
Are there any further questions? Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, similar to a bill that we laid on the table last week, there seems to be a lot of categories of licensure here, and I was wondering if Senator Carlson could clarify how many new categories of licensure are we looking at. There isn't just one licensed certified fitter of orthotics, prosthetics, and podorthics. It appears there are several categories.
Thank you. I see Mr. Miller's approach. I think it is in section subdivision 2 that indicates approximately 9. Is that correct? And would you please articulate the concern that about why that's necessary or if it's able to be more succinctly approached?
Yes. Currently, there are practitioners in single disciplines of orthotics, prosthetics, and then there are dual certified practitioners who are prosthetists, orthotists. So although it appears to be many categories from that aspect, we're really talking about the same category of professional. So it's either certified prosthetist, orthotist, or certified orthotist, which I am, or certified prosthetist. So those are three categories. Mastectomy fitters are certainly in a entirely separate category. And in just a brief comment, the certified mastectomy fitter is certainly in an included professional category in this licensure bill. The assistant level and the fitter level and the technician level are all specific to orthotic and prosthetic practice, where we're doing high-level custom orthotic devices in a self-contained lab, that type of thing. Were there other categories that you had a concern over?
It's just, Madam Chair, and
Senator Benson.
Again, we're running into this micromanagement, multiple licensure, no opportunity for kind of cross practices in these fields, and creating barriers that, well, and Madam Chair, I don't believe we've heard specific evidence that consumers are being harmed. It seems that these devices are mostly referred by physician. And so I'd like some clarification as to what consumer harm we're trying to mitigate by enacting licensure. Have people been defrauded? Have doctors sent someone to a non-certified fitter, and we've run into trouble? I just don't want to get too far down the path of licensing people without actually understanding how much harm has occurred.
Within, if I may,
Mr. Miller?
Within this realm of treatment, all of our referrals are medically necessary, and the individuals present themselves with a physician prescription. It's by prescription order only. The other aspect of looking at the product and the scope of practice that I've identified, and even there's items of agreement that we have with the opposition, and there's certainly a lot of reasonable comments that were made. The incidence of diabetes in this country and in the state is on track for achieving epidemic proportions. One of the categories of great concern is that the state of Minnesota has no oversight whatsoever as to the type of person who can provide care. And that's really what we're looking at, is if this is a opportunity to provide care in a growing, expansive market for individuals who are properly credentialed and licensed within the state of Minnesota, we have absolutely no problems with that. The problem enters in when there's potential for fraud and abuse. I have no documented study to tell you numbers in that. In response to your question about that, however, the potential remains for some serious issues to take place, the worst of which would be if a patient would suffer.
Senator Benson.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Miller, I think you testified previously, perhaps it was another testifier, that you could not sell prescription therapeutic shoes without being certified by the company that makes them. Was that you, or was that another testifier?
That was not my testimony, and I believe there were some terms and definitions in there that were somewhat mixed. Shoe manufacturers do not certify people in fitting their products. They do instruct people in fitting their products and present them with a certificate of attendance. The issue that we have here is that there is not an independent third party that offers a credentialing that individual's knowledge and skill and ability to carry through on that education. So there is a serious missing link between having education and then having credentials or qualifications that have been deemed adequate to provide quality care. And I'm not pointing any fingers at anybody, and I'm not saying any names, but there's a disconnect between what manufacturers tell you are capable of doing. Just because a manufacturer instructs you in a procedure and gives you a certificate of completion, that's a long ways from all of the steps, and not as an accredited facility. That doesn't even enter into this bill. We're talking about credentialed individuals in the field.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Senator Benson, did you? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I may have a suggestion for Senator Carlson and perhaps for the chair, and that is that I do think there is some good argument for some of what you're trying to do here. I also think, as Ms. Stout said, well, she agrees that some of the concerns that were raised are legitimate ones, but you don't want to do it on the fly, and I'm not sure this committee is able to do that on the fly. And I kind of wonder if the chair and Senator Carlson would like to if we take the bill up a different day, lay it over for now, and encourage you to have your folks sit down with some of the others, because I'm not sure where to draw the line. I certainly think some of the off-the-shelf things that are prefabricated things, and a lot of everything, I'm sure almost any kind of prosthetic device, parts of it are prefabricated and so on, but there is some line here that I don't think is quite sorted out here, and perhaps somebody who's doing art supports for diabetes or whatever may need certification or something, but I'm not sure they need the full scope of what this bill is putting them in for. And so I guess I'm wondering if, Senator Carlson, if you might think it would make more sense for, rather than trying to do it here in the committee, actually have a sit-down meeting with some of your folks and some of the folks who raise concerns, because I think some people may not want any of this bill. There's some who may like everything in the bill, but I think most of us are kind of looking for somewhere where to draw the line, and so I'm wondering if that might make sense.
Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, I think you're correct here. I've spoken to Ms. Stout just briefly about it, and I think you're probably looking at the same areas that I am here, sections Q and R on 317 and 319, where the device that's being fitted does not require professional advice or judgment or require substantial clinical judgment. That might be something that we'd want to look at, maybe an exemption. And you're absolutely correct. I was trying to do it on the fly, and I don't think that's going to work. But I would like to have Ms. Stout give a little bit more information on the potential for harm and other issues that surround the non-licensure.
Ms. Stout, and did you have a question? Missed out.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'll keep this very brief. We have observed a fair amount of harm in the area of orthotics and prosthetics, where there were people that were doing something that they were not prepared or licensed or trained, trained to do. I have to tell you, we're a national organization, and the data that we've collected, I would have to go back and see if any of it's from Minnesota specifically. I can tell you that in a couple of instances that I've looked at, one from Florida in particular, there was a substantial amount of harm to a patient because the person really didn't know what they were doing and they weren't properly prepared. And we've seen an increase in that activity in some areas, so this is what we're trying to prevent. I think we can bring to you some good data about patient harm.
Thank you, Ms. Stout. I think we all also heard your earlier testimony about the importance of certain areas of intervention, allowing the public to have a process through which they can indicate their concerns or their complaints, and that the profession itself has an opportunity to address issues among its membership, and that that's also a part of this bill. Correct. But I appreciate your openness to the suggestion I think that Senator Marty is making, and that is that it might be helpful to at least in these two areas that I heard of, is that some really clear delineation between what is necessary and what may not be in terms of over-the-counter kinds of less invasive is the term I tick of, I think of, but less problematic in terms of its potential for harm. And then a further examination of how many levels of licensing or certification, if that language needs to be tightened down or clarified, so that we aren't eliminating the ability to people to do their work when they're certified or when they've been received the appropriate level of training. How to be able to do that, but also allow us to be able to have an intervention if there's an error or omission. So would you like to...
Madam Chair, I don't know if you need a vote to lay it over. I think you could just informally do it. And
you can just lay it on the table.
And then if I could ask one more thing, when you're looking at it, I think it's not just the whether it's prefabricated or whatever, but also I think one of the witnesses said something about they're not really part of a treatment plan. They're simply providing a product that is according to somebody else's treatment plan. I'm not sure if that's where you draw the line, but... That's one thing I hope you'll look at in those meetings with them. Yeah. I'll move. If you want me to move to lay it on the table, I'll do so.
There's a motion to lay it on the table. Is that a discussable motion? Is there any further discussion? I just want to say I really appreciate the efforts on the part of your organization to try to improve the quality here. And so I think that this is a great initial conversation for our committee on this subject. So all those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? It's laid on the table. Thank you very much, Senator Carlson. Senator
Thank
Wicklund.
Madam Chair and the committee.
Senate File 799. This is a bill about professional clinical counselors, licensing provisions, and modifications.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I am here to in support of Senate File 1799, and this is a bill brought forward by the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy. The purpose of the bill is to clarify that all licensor supervisors must meet the approved supervisor requirements in both statute and rule, and also it creates a permanent method to license professional clinical counselor licensure after August 1st of 2014. There is a conversion method that is in place today in statute, but it expires on August 1st. So there's a desire to have a permanent method in, that is in law. And I have a testifier here. Would you like to go over the details? Or, okay. And I'll let Carrie...
Rick Siegel.
Who is here from the Board of
Behavioral Health and Therapy. Thank you, Ms. Wright Siegel. Please introduce yourself, where you're from, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Carrie Rick Siegel. You can think of it like like bicycle, if that helps. And I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy, a position I've held since 2004. And Senate File 1799 is essentially a housekeeping bill. All of the language already exists in statute in the LPCC, which is the Licensed Professional Clinical Counselor General Method, for persons who go directly for the clinical license. So every bit of language already exists in statute, and we are just asking for the committee's help in adopting these changes so that we can have a permanent conversion method for those licensees with our board who have the LPC license already.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Ms. Wicklund, is there anything further you'd like to say at this time, Senator?
No, I think that it's important that this be taken care of this year so that there is a permanent method in place and one that reflects the board's desire to have a more consistent process for all of the conversion.
Thank you. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on Senate File 1799? Seeing no one, Senator Wicklund, your motion will be.
Let's see if I can find it here.
Your motion would be to recommend pass and referral to the Judiciary Committee, and the bill will also be considered for inclusion in the omnibus bill. Is that your motion?
Does someone have a comment on how it's been chosen to move it to Judiciary, or is there a...
Ms. Kavanaugh?
Madam Chair and Senator, they have requested it, and it is because of, on page 2, putting in a good moral character. I did talk to the Judiciary Council and said that this is something that is currently in law, but they are of the mind that they want to start looking at adding that phrase to licenses.
Can you tell me which line it was again? Just
page
so I know.
2, line 24.
Okay.
You must not have enough to do.
Apparently.
We can make it immoral.
Madam Chair.
Senator Wicklund.
Carrie Rectigal has more information on current language.
Please, I came looking for your name, so would you reintroduce yourself and make your comment, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Carrie Rexical. And I would like to address the issue of sending it to the Judiciary Committee because of the good moral character language. I would like to point out, and maybe you've already said this, but in Minnesota Statutes 148B5301, which is the licensed professional clinical counselor requirements for licensure, that already exist for the general method people, and that would be those who go directly for this license, that language already exists in subdivision 1, parens 2. And so if we're just trying to match up the conversion method to match this one that's already in the law, I'm just wondering, you know, what we would be talking about in the Judiciary Committee.
Ms. Kavanaugh.
Madam Chair, I did tell them that and said that it was already an existing law, and I believe they still want to see it. So,
well,
if a chairperson requests to hear it, then we will honor that. You would have time to re-refer to discuss that further with them, Senator, but
sure.
For right now, we have a request from the committee, so we would refer it to that committee. But that the language will be for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you.
And that would be your motion.
Yes.
Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. All right. Senate File 1792, Minnesota Massage and Body Therapy Art. Senator Hoffman is not able to be here at this time, so we'll proceed. We will not pass out this amendment. Proceed to Senate File 511, Advanced Practice Registered Nurse Healthcare Delivery Access Improvement.
Distribute.
stuff is right. I had a copy. I had to bring you a copy. I had given you a copy, but I don't know what you did with it. Yeah, it's being passed out right now. Here. Yeah, right here. Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Senator Sharon.
Sorry, please. Taking us a little bit of time to pull ourselves together here.
That's okay. Please proceed when you're ready to present your bill.
Great. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to present Senate File 511. This is a bill that relates to advanced practice registered nurses. It is a bill that has been in the process of development over a very long period of time. It has come forward and been asked to be worked on many, many times. We have had very dedicated stakeholders engage in a great deal of conversation about how to construct this language of this bill, and have had some success in being able to make significant improvements in the bill. I think that you will hear today that there continue to be disagreements about elements of the bill, but the disagreements are not necessarily those that are resolvable by language, but may simply be a disagreement on course and direction. So with that, I would like you to know that we have a number of people who wish to be heard on the bill, but we want to begin with a delete all amendment.
Yes, so Senator Sharon moves to amend Senate File Number 511 with a delete all the A5. Is that correct?
It's the A5 amendment.
Do we have discussion?
Yeah, if anyone wants to.
That's okay,
I can make the motion to pass the delete all amendment, the A5 amendment.
So all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? And now your delete all amendment or delete all amendment replaces the bill. So.
Thank you very much. May I ask, is this Senate File 511? Organized in relationship to the delete all amendment. It is. Okay. Thank you. So let's begin by sort of going at 30,000 foot over the bill. Senate File creates a separate license for advanced practice registered nurses. APRNs is the term that you'll hear us use, and it permits licensed advanced practice nurses to practice independently without a collaborative agreement. It does not in any way diminish the capacity for collaboration. It simply takes language out that says that collaboration has to be articulated in writing. Section 1 makes a conforming change to the definition of an advanced practice nurse to specify that the individual is licensed. It defines what the certification is. It modifies the definition of the clinical nurse specialist's practice. It adds language in this delete all to define collaboration, because a great deal of the discussion has been around what the meaning of collaboration is. It modifies the definition of midwife practice. Section 7, especially subdivision 11, modifies the definition of the nurse practitioner's practice. This is probably the heart of the bill. The practice is defined as providing care. It's very defined as health promotion, disease prevention, health education and counseling, providing health assessment and screening activities, diagnosing, treating, and facilitating patient management of their acute and chronic illnesses and diseases, ordering and performing, supervising, and interpreting diagnostic studies, prescribing pharmacological and non-pharmacological therapies, consulting with, collaborating with, especially collaborating with, or referring to other healthcare professionals as warranted by the needs of the client. So critical in that language is the defining basis for those functions are the needs of the patient, are the needs of the patient. Section 9, Section 8 is defining the population focuses of the practices. Section 9 modifies the definition of the practice of advanced practice registered nurses, or APRNs, to require the performance of an expanded scope of nursing in at least one of the recognized advanced practice registered nurses' roles for at least one population focus. Let's see if I can explain that. In English, it means that advanced practice nurses are defined by their population focus. For example, advanced practice pediatric nurse. The practice also requires the APRN to be accountable to the patients for the quality of care that they are rendering. So the responsibility, of course, is always to the patients. They're responsible for recognizing the limits of their knowledge and experience, which we ask of all healthcare professionals. We ask for the planning for the management of situations beyond the APRN's capacity, as we ask all healthcare professionals to do, to recognize the limits of their ability and to refer to specialists or those beyond their scope of practice. And for planning for the management of, for planning for the management of referral beyond your experience. The practice also includes of APRNs accepting referrals from, consulting with, and collaborating with, or referring to other health care professionals when warranted, again, based on the need of the patient. Section 10 modifies the definition of prescribing to state clearly that it does not include the recommending or administering of a drug of therapeutic or therapeutic device for anesthesia and related services by a certified registered nurse anesthetist. Modifies the definition of prescribing to state that it does not include the recommending or administering of a drug or therapeutic device for anesthesia. Section 11 amends the definition of prescription to clarify any prescription for a drug must comply with this section. So the definition of prescription. Section 12 defines primary care provider. Section 13 defines a registered nurse anesthetist practice. Section 14 defines the roles of the advanced practice registered nurse. Others are conforming changes to language. There is in Section 17 the requirement that the advanced practice nurse must be licensed by the Board of Nursing as an advanced practice registered nurse, and specifies the requirements for the licensure. I just would highlight that because, as is true in all professions, there are boards that oversee that profession. They are responsible for the discipline of that profession, for making certain that that group of professionals meets the educational requirements that are necessary to provide safely within that scope of practice. And this is articulating clearly that the Board of Nursing, again, has its responsibility for nursing practice. It creates the Section 18 creates a grandfather clause that requires the board to issue a license to an applicant who does not meet the educational requirements for licensure if they're recognized for practice on a certain date. It's the grandfathering concept. Section 19 discusses APRN licensure by endorsement. Section 20, conforming changes, and specifies that an applicant for registration must provide evidence of current certification or recertification. Let's see. Conforming language. Section 23 is the next section that speaks to the fact that the title, its title protection and clarity for the public to know who it is that they are seeing and that the use of the term is protected for those who practice within this scope of practice. Section 25 specifies that an APRN is authorized to diagnose, prescribe, and institute therapy or referrals of patients to healthcare agencies and providers. They can prescribe, procure, sign for, record, administer over-the-counter, legend, and controlled substances, including sample drugs, and that the advanced practice nurse can plan and initiate a therapeutic regime, including ordering and prescribing durable medical devices, et cetera. So it clearly is describing the prescriptive authority. Section 26 requires the APRNs to comply with the DEA requirements related to controlled substances. This is an important element of the bill. Section 34 specifies that an APRN who practices advanced practice registered nursing without a current license or certification has to pay a penalty. Let's see if there's any other heightened... other modifications of language. And then Section 37 includes the prescription drug monitoring program that a licensed advanced practice registered nurse may prescribe, administer, and dispense controlled substances that are in Schedule 2 through 5. The last part of the bill is repealing languages that takes the old language out and replaces it with this current language. We're going to begin with some testimony that gives you a better sense of the context out of which this bill is coming. I know that there are many people that want to be heard on this subject. It's one in which I have a great deal of care about, coming from a legislative position, not necessarily out of my nursing position, and from the legislative position coming from the place that provides access to care as we have wanted in the reforms that we've made in this state to allow people to practice within their full scope of practice, and our concern that that be done in a safe way, that the patient's safety concerns and issues are addressed, which is not only our responsibility, but then the oversight ability of the Board of Nursing. So with that, I'd like to turn this over to Mary Chesney, who will introduce herself, and unless there's questions for me, we can begin.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. Madam Chair, my name is Mary Chesney, and I'm a clinical associate professor and director of the Doctor of Nursing Practice Program at the University of Minnesota School of Nursing. And this is the program in which we educate all four roles of advanced practice registered nurses, or APRNs, as I'll refer to them here on. And that includes nurse practitioners, nurse midwives, clinical nurse specialists, and nurse anesthetists. I am testifying today in my capacity as president of the Minnesota APRN Coalition. Madam Chair and members, thank you so much for this opportunity to speak in support of Senate File 511. You have handouts today, and they are the ones numbered 1 through 5 up in the upper right-hand corner, and they're handwritten. I apologize, they do not all contain logos, but these are the handouts to which I will be referring during my testimony. This bill increases Minnesota citizens' access to health care and choice of health care provider by removing barriers from APRN practice that currently exist in Minnesota's Nurse Practice Act. Current law requires APRNs to practice within an environment that allows for collaborative management of patients with an identified physician or group of physicians. This requirement often results in health systems or insurers requiring that an APRN be either the employee of a practice with a physician or that they hire a physician to contract for collaborative management services. A second barrier in current law is the requirement for the APRN to maintain a written prescriptive agreement, a piece of paper that lists all of the drug categories that an APRN may prescribe. This is signed annually by the
supervising physician, and the APRN. In some instances, these barriers prevent some APRNs from being able to practice at all in Minnesota. In some cases, these barriers create scenarios in which APRNs must pay a significant percentage of their annual income to contract for physician collaboration or prescriptive authority supervision. This legislation would enact a national standardized APRN consensus model of regulation. This model is endorsed by the National Council of State Boards of Nursing. It's endorsed by the Minnesota Board of Nursing and 47 other national nursing organizations. The model establishes a licensure for APRNs based on passing a national certification exam in one of the four APRN roles and in one of six population foci: family, individual across the lifespan, adult gerontology, pediatrics, neonatal, women gender-specific, and psychiatric mental health. Although we are aware that numerous physicians support this legislation, arguments have been raised by organized physician groups opposing this legislation. And today I'd like to address each of these individual arguments. The first is that without physician oversight or supervision, APRN practice will not be safe, APRNs will go well beyond their scope of practice, or the quality of care will not be as good. To refute this argument, I'd like to turn your attention to handout number 2 that refers to the Institute of Medicine's report on the future of nursing. The IOM is an esteemed member of the National Academies of Science. Reports and recommendations from all IOM reports must be based upon an exhaustive review of research evidence by a panel of nationally recognized experts. In 2010, the IOM issued a comprehensive evidence-based report on the future of nursing by an expert panel of physicians, nurses, legal scholars, health administrators, and policymakers. Based on review of the evidence, the panel recommended that scope of practice barriers be removed. The panel found a substantial body of research to support that all four roles of advanced practice registered nurses deliver safe, quality care comparable to the same type of care delivered by physicians, and in some cases with better outcomes than those by physicians. Based on the evidence, the panel recommended that state legislators enact this nationalized standardized APRN consensus model in all 50 states. Further, the report states, and I quote, "The contention that APRNs are less able than physicians to deliver care that is safe, effective, and efficient is not supported by research that has examined this question." I'd like to also turn your attention to the handout that's numbered number 3. At the top of the handout, you will see the states listed. 7 states to date have independence for all 4 roles of APRNs, and then you can see each of the different APRN roles, and there are different numbers. Clinical nurse specialists, for example, is 13 states, CRNAs, 22 states, and so on. As far as evidence for safety, it's important to note that we cannot find any substantiated evidence that indicates there's been any problem in the states that have allowed independence for APRNs. Some of these states have had independent status for APRNs for more than 10 years. It's also important to note that to date, none of the above states has attempted to repeal or has repealed this legislation that grants independence to the APRN for roles. Also, I will just call your attention, there are 2 tables. One is 2009 data. One, it contains 2012 data. And what we've listed Minnesota, and then the other states listed in each of these tables are states that currently have independent practice. I'd like to call your attention to the right-hand side of each table, and you'll see columns listed HIPDB. It's a database that refers to action items. So someone has a complaint that's brought against them and the medical board or the nursing board takes an action for these people. So I want to walk across. If you look, for example, in Arizona on the 2012 data in the back part of the page, you'll notice under HIPD for nurse practitioners, it has a 1 to 521 ratio. That means that there was one action taken by the board against 521 per every 521 nurse practitioners in the state. In contrast, that same data for doctors of osteopathy, there was one action taken by a board against per every six DOs in the state, and one action taken by the board against every seven. So that's how to read this table. But it provides evidence that things are still going pretty similarly in the states that have independence. A second argument is that physicians receive more education and training than APRNs, and this is why they should maintain oversight of APRNs. Physicians practice medicine. Advanced practice nurses practice nursing. Each has overlapping skill sets. The relevant question is, does each provider have the education and training they need to safely and effectively perform their scope of practice and meet patient needs? Physicians receive 4 years of graduate medical school during which they study and practice across all populations of patients in a wide variety of settings such as surgery, internal medicine, pathology, radiology, and so on. Typically, physicians focus on their practice specialty during a minimum of a 3-year residency. APRNs pursue their general nursing education for all populations during their baccalaureate undergraduate education or in a post-baccalaureate or master's of nursing program. They focus on their narrowed APRN practice specialty during 2 or 3 years of graduate education and clinical training. Yes, physicians have more total hours of education and training because their practice scope is very broad and much of it focuses on hospital-based, highly complex, acute care in people with complex medical conditions or life-threatening diseases. For example, the OBGYN physician spends their 3 years of residency learning to deliver primary care, prenatal care, postpartum care to women, attending women during labor and delivery. However, he or she must also learn how to perform cesarean section deliveries, surgeries such as hysterectomies, or diagnose or treat women with gynecological cancers. In contrast, the nurse midwife spends 2 to 3 years of graduate education training learning how to deliver primary care, prenatal care, and postpartum care for women and attend them during labor and vaginal birth. There are differences in education because APRNs and physicians have significantly different scopes of practice. The bottom line is that more than 2 decades of research evidence supports that APRNs are educated to deliver safe, effective, quality care. A third argument is that granting APRNs full practice authority without a requirement for physician supervision is in conflict with moving toward team-based care. Nothing in this legislation restricts the ability of an APRN to practice within a team-based model. However, the state issues health provider licenses as a means to ensure that an individual, not a team, has basic competence to practice safely and effectively. The state does not license teams, and APRN's ability to be licensed or practice should not be tied to a requirement that they practice with a specifically identified physician or team. APRNs, like physicians, believe that team care is optimal for providing comprehensive care to people who are complex, have complex medical conditions, or chronic conditions. APRNs differ with the Minnesota Medical Association's stance that the team should be physician-led. In fact, the MMA's stance is in conflict with the new model supported by the National Interprofessional Education Collaborative that describes interprofessional teams as non-hierarchical, and with the leadership of the team based on the needs of the patient. Their stance also conflicts with the 2009 statute with regard to the ability of APRNs to lead healthcare homes. So in Minnesota in 2009, we did not restrict leadership of a healthcare home to a physician. The physician-led teams are not always practical or feasible in the rural area. Not all patients require a costly team-based approach. A healthy person who simply needs an annual checkup, screening, or treatment for minor ailments like sore throat can be treated with high quality and lower cost by an APRN. This legislation does include language that tells us that we all often collaborate, consult, and refer based on the needs of the patient. A final argument is that physicians should provide supervision for APRN prescribing practices, particularly for prescribing Schedule II narcotic opioid drugs. There is no evidence to date that links increased narcotic opioid drug abuse with APRN prescribing practices. APRNs use a holistic nursing approach to pain management that includes non-pharmacological methods such as application of heat or cold, massage, non-narcotic medications, referral to physical therapy, chiropractic services, and complementary alternative therapies such as biofeedback, relaxation imagery, acupuncture, or acupressure. APRNs in Minnesota already prescribe Schedule II narcotic medications and other medications under the prescriptive agreement I described earlier. In practice, physicians are not providing prescription oversight for each prescription written or every patient seen. Yet Minnesota APRNs are prescribing safely with fewer prescribing complaints than physicians. And for this, I would have you look at handout number 4. On the back, when you have time later, there is a table, table 1, that describes the various complaints that are related to prescribing inappropriately. Thus far, we can't find evidence of Schedule II prescribing problems in states where APRNs are allowed to independently prescribe these drugs. It's also important to note that Florida, one of the few states in the nation that doesn't allow APRNs to prescribe Schedule II drugs, Florida has the worst narcotic abuse rate in the country. I also have National Council of State Board of Nursing data from 2011, and they compared the rate of inappropriate prescribing between APRNs in states where they have independent prescribing and APRNs in states where they do not. The rate of inappropriate prescribing is 0.039% in states where APRNs have independent prescribing. The rate, in contrast with states that do not, is 0.056%. The monthly discipline rate was compared looking at APRNs versus physicians on a monthly discipline rate based on prescribing errors. And the percentage of discipline rates are 0.11% for physicians. They're 0.05% for APRNs. Madam Chair and members, Minnesota has 103 primary care health provider shortages already. We have 53 mental health provider shortages already. With MnSure and Medicaid expansion, there are many more citizens who need access to care. We need all hands on deck, and we need all of those providers to be able to practice to the fullest extent of their education and training. This legislation increases citizen access to APRN providers. Other than random anecdotal horror stories, there isn't research evidence to support the opposition's arguments. In fact, there's an abundance of more than 2 decades of evidence, and you can see that on handout 5, that APRNs have adequate education to provide safe, high-quality, cost-effective care. I respectfully urge you to vote yes for Senate File 511. I'm happy to entertain any questions you have. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Chesney. Senator Sharon, did you want to proceed through all of the testifiers and then go back for questions or entertain questions as we go?
We can entertain. I would like to complete the testimony here at the table, and then if people are ready for questions for the testifiers, we could accept that then and then move to the next group of testifiers, if that's your preference.
Sure. Yes, that would work. Our next testifier, Catherine Wode-White, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Madam Chair and Senators, I want to thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 511. My name is Catherine White. I am a certified registered nurse anesthetist and the incoming president of the Minnesota Association of Nurse Anesthetists. I currently teach in the University of
Minnesota. Excuse me, Ms. White. Can you pull the microphone just a little closer? You have to really get very close to these so that we can hear you.
I currently teach. Do you want me to start over or just? Thank you, ma'am. I currently teach in the University of Minnesota Nurse Anesthesia Program, a 3-year-long graduate program that leads to a clinical doctorate in nursing. Our program is both rigorous and extensive. Students are thoroughly grounded in science courses that provide the foundation for the many subsequent hours of clinical experiences in a variety of settings. Our students, like all CRNAs, receive an excellent academic and clinical foundation in the principles of pain management during their graduate nurse anesthesia program. As such, our CRNAs have long used pain management techniques to address the acute and chronic pain syndromes of Minnesota patients, particularly in the rural areas of Minnesota. According to a recent report by the Institute of Medicine, chronic pain affects 100 million Americans. The report, called Relieving Pain in America, estimates that chronic pain costs the United States $635 billion in lost productivity and direct costs to the healthcare system. The IOM report urged healthcare and insurance providers to promote integrated patient care through collaboration and coordination among healthcare professionals. But the IOM also noted this cannot be done without first removing the barriers that prevent comprehensive treatment of chronic pain. And I quote, "A number of barriers, including regulatory, legal, institutional, financial, and geographic barriers, limit the availability of pain care and contribute to the disparities found among some groups. Government agencies, healthcare providers, and public and private funders of healthcare should adopt a comprehensive strategic approach to reduce or eliminate these barriers," end quote. One barrier in Minnesota is the collaborative agreement. This is especially evident in Minnesota's rural areas, where CRNAs are the primary providers of anesthesia care. Currently, we have CRNAs in Minnesota that do pain injections as a part of their rural practice of anesthesia. These injections are done on the referral from a physician. These physicians recognize the knowledge, skills, and training of these nurse anesthetists in pain management and their long track record of safety. Without the pain management services CRNAs provide, many patients would have to drive significant distances to get their pain injections. Medicare already recognizes the quality and cost effectiveness of CRNAs. Under the CMS opt-out, CRNAs already practice with a high degree of autonomy. CMS also reimburses pain injection and pain management services that are delivered by CRNAs within the state's scope of practice. For CRNAs, like any other provider, the patient's healthcare needs guide the course of treatment, including collaboration with other healthcare professionals. And when necessary for patient safety and best practice, we refer our patients to the appropriate provider. We also recognize the importance of continuing education for CRNAs to stay current with the emerging science of pain management. This is no different than what is required of physicians or other licensed healthcare professionals. That is why the American Association of Nurse Anesthetists has developed continuing education courses on pain management techniques and procedures. In addition, Hamline University is transitioning its current advanced pain management certificate to a postgraduate pain management fellowship with both didactic and clinical components. This year-long program will be accredited by the Council on Accreditation of Nurse Anesthesia Educational Programs late this year or in early 2015. Graduates of the Hamline Fellowship Program will also be eligible to sit for a certification exam in pain management through the National Board of Certification and Recertification of Nurse Anesthetists. For 150 years, CRNAs have specialized in keeping patients safe and pain-free in all kinds of healthcare settings. Remove the barriers and let us provide care to Minnesota patients within the full scope of our professional practice. Please support Senate File 511. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. White. Are there questions? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Ms. White. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. White, can you tell me a little more about the continuing ed requirements? You said they are similar to what your primary physician or any physician has to. What are those requirements for continuing ed?
Currently, the requirement is for 40 CEUs, continuing education units, and a unit is roughly 8 hours. Those requirements are about to increase, and I don't know exactly where the new ones have landed, but they are we're increasing the requirements, and also including a clinical component to it. So in other words, you can't just sit in a classroom. You have to actually demonstrate competency. So I can get those for you and submit them to the committee.
Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. White, I'd appreciate that. Are they succinct with what the physicians have also? Or is it above and beyond what physicians have as far as continuing ed and just basic pain management education?
The fellowship will be 1 year in length, and most fellowships are typically 1 year in length. I'm not familiar with the American Society of Anesthesiologists or the American Board of Anesthesiology requirements for continuing education, but again, I can get those and get them to you, Senator.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was looking on page 3 as Senator Sharon, as you were introducing Subdivision 11, kind of the heart of the bill, and I was noticing that it seems like line 3.112, which allows APRNs then to prescribe therapies, I can't say that. Somebody else is going to have to say that for me, therapies. But that seems to be the real difference in what current law states, which specifically says that they cannot be provided. But this changes it to where they can be provided. And so I want to know, what does that really include, pharmacological therapies that can now be prescribed by APRNs if this legislation passes? So what kind of therapies are we talking about? It almost looks like a little bit of an expanded scope. And I always think it's important to know what is that. And then after you describe what that is, if you can tell me, is there in training, additional training, how would that be handled?
Senator Nelson, Senator I can Sharon? Answer that question.
Thank you. Ms. White?
Yes, Ms. White.
Go ahead.
Currently, the nurses do prescribe pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic agents. All the bill does is remove an artificial barrier of this collaborative agreement that is signed and actually provides physician oversight of some sort, but it doesn't really that prescriptive agreement does not apply to each prescription and each patient. So this is not an expansion of the scope of practice.
Madam Chair?
Senator Nelson?
Well, I don't see, as I'm reading current law, which is struck out in lines 3.1 through 3.5, it says that the part that's being struck out is providing non-pharmacologic treatment. But it never. Where does it say in current law that APRNs can prescribe pharmacologic treatment independently? I don't know. Is that current? And also, I really need to know what that entails and what kind of training would allow someone to do that independently.
Ms. Chesney, did you?
Madam Chair, how APRNs have been able to prescribe thus far under that written agreement is actually in the Prescribing Act, and it refers to the fact that we prescribe right now under a written agreement with a physician, so it's considered basically under a delegated medical act. So it's elsewhere in pharmacy law, and I'm thinking that Shirley Bracken of the Board of Nursing, Madam Chair, could probably tell us exactly precisely where it is, but I do want to state we are prescribing drugs now. The prescriptive agreement is simply a category of drugs. So it'll say antibiotics, immunizations. It's not listing specific drugs, nor do we have oversight for the need to dose those drugs, to write the prescription. We have to have an agreement signed with the physician saying that, yes, we can prescribe these various drugs. But it is not, it's really important that although it's listed as a medically delegated kind of thing in pharmacy law, that we not think about that every prescription that's being written has some sort of oversight. And in fact, in many cases, the APRN may go for days and days and be able to do prescriptions. And just as a physician would do if they had a question, you know, if we have a question about something, yes, we can talk to a colleague. But we are already doing that and have since the mid-1990s.
Senator Nelson?
So I appreciate that clarification. What I really want to know is what does that include, pharmacologic therapies, and what kind of training, since I think the initiative of this bill would be that it be prescribed independently as opposed to under this collaborative agreement, which I understand from visits with many of my nurses, maybe that collaborative agreement is, and sometimes maybe nothing more than a signature. I understand that. But I still want to know what that includes and what kind of additional training then APRNs have that would allow them to successfully and in a way protecting patients to now prescribe these pharmacologic treatments, whatever they are, safely. You know, is there additional training? What is it that, or is it already part of their licensure? That's what I need to hear.
Ms. Chesney?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, currently and for decades now, the all four roles of advanced practice registered nurses have as part of their general curriculum in their graduate degree program, course in pharmacology, course in pharmacotherapeutics, which is not only how do the drugs work, but how does one use them in practice? You know, what's what are the appropriate ways in which one prescribes? Then our students also, when they are out in their clinical training, are practicing writing prescriptions, working with a preceptor that may be a physician, it may be a senior advanced practice registered nurse in the same category. The other piece is that it's also important to note that we prescribe in a fairly narrow focus. So, for example, I'm in pediatrics. I'm never going to prescribe drugs that induce labor. I'm not prescribing drugs for someone who's geriatric and needing to know what's going on with that geriatric patient. So our prescribing within that program is very specific to whatever your particular population and your particular role is. So people have had that training in advanced practice nursing in the United States now for more than three decades, and I would say, if anything, it's becoming more and more sophisticated, realizing that this is an important role. And again, I would just go back to my data and the testimony, but basically when you look at independent practice states, there aren't differences between those who are prescribing independently in states compared to those who are in states that require this medical oversight and written prescriptive agreement.
Just to finalize.
Okay.
Senator Nelson. Thank you. Just to kind of wrap up, I understand the real need to have medical professionals work to the top of their licensure, which I think is the intent of this bill. So I definitely understand that. But what I am still not clear about is what that additional independently being able to prescribe pharmacologic therapies is, what kind of drugs it is, or if it isn't, or maybe it's just therapies. And then also the coursework that would allow APRNs to, that's already part of their coursework, that would how does that compare with the coursework that those collaborating physicians currently have regarding this particular area of the prescribing the drugs? And, of course, I am concerned about the opiate. We have an epidemic here of drug diversion, opiate addiction in general in society. And so I want to be really clear on this aspect of the bill.
Ms. Chesney, do you have
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson. I will not speak for my physician colleagues because it would probably be helpful for someone who actually goes through medical school to more accurately describe this. But it's my understanding that a lot of the prescribing happens when they're in their various rotations. So they're working with a physician in a primary care setting, and they're practicing, doing prescribing. I would imagine the physicians also have a pharmacologic type of course. But I would leave it for them to say specifically. I couldn't begin to speak to the class hours and compare those. I would say that I think if you were to ask physicians, they would tell you they have many more hours practicing prescribing. But again, I want to remind everyone that that's because they prescribe over a broad area. So the pediatrician may be learning to prescribe chemotherapy. They may be learning to prescribe, you know, vasopressor, very serious drugs you'd use in the ICU. They're doing the wide gamut, whereas, for example, the pediatric nurse practitioner would be focused on things like asthma medications, immunizations, sort of your antibiotic treatment for various bacterial infections, those types of things. So it's difficult because in some ways it's apples to oranges in terms of the scope and in terms of the broad expanse of what you're going to prescribe for. But what we do know, and I think this is the part that is very important, is that the studies of people independently prescribing as APRNs, there isn't evidence to support that they're not doing so safely. And there's been no move to repeal any of the legislation that has given autonomous prescribing to APRNs in other states because it's been found to be helpful to increase access to care.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Benson, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Chesney, I wanted to, at the beginning of your testimony, you said that nurses practice nursing and doctors practice medicine. Is there a definition that differentiates those two? Because I'm having trouble with where the line is here. I feel like there's general agreement that there should be some changes to the Advanced Practice Nurse Act so that we do get an expansion of access and expansion of quality. I don't know where the line is. And one of the first things you brought up was nursing versus medicine. So if you could help me understand where the line is between physician practice and what you see as advanced practice, nurse practice.
Ms. Chesney.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson. The difficulty comes in that there is overlap. And in fact, in all of the different professions coming together, pharmacy, medicine, nursing, when they've come together to talk about scopes, the real difficulty is that there's overlap everywhere. My scope overlaps with physicians. My scope overlaps with pharmacy. So I don't know that I can give you a sharply demarcated line. What I can tell you is there are differences in the framework. So physician practices focus on disease, diagnosis of disease, differential diagnosis, cure, treatment. I would say that nursing has a holistic health focus. It tends to look at trying to keep people as healthy as possible, living the best quality of life. We tend to focus a lot on health promotion. So right now, you know, you do hear physicians talking about health promotion, prevention, but that actually came out of the practice of nursing. So preventing disease, working on healthy lifestyle with people, nutrition, the various things that keep people healthy. So we bring that perspective to the work that we do. But definitely there's overlap when you talk about diagnosing a sore throat or in terms of how we're going to go through the steps of diagnosing that and the prescription we might write to treat if it's bacterial, strep throat. So it's difficult for me to be able to give you a sharp line that at some point you step over and it's medicine.
May I add to that, Senator Benson? I think
Senator Sharon.
I think that is difficult for you to understand that because you might think that somehow you could make a list of things that differentiate them. But we all take blood pressures. We all take temperatures. We all use similar assessment tools. Those are not the way to differentiate between the professions. But another area that I want to emphasize, I don't know if you heard it with all that's being said here, is that the advanced practice nurse's boundaries around their scope of practice are defined by their specialty practice. They do not prescribe medications that are not appropriate for within that frame of reference. Psych, mental health, nurses are not prescribing medications that are outside of that narrow focus. So there is a boundary around what it is that the person is doing defined by the particular advanced practice model that they're licensed in.
And a general practitioner is not limited to that. That rotational process, that process of education in which you talk about more time or more hours, has to do with the fact that we have not narrowed their scope. We have narrowed the scope of an advanced practice nurse in earlier law. And there, in the first paragraph of this A5 amendment describes that the how scope of practice is determined because of concerns that people have asked during our preparations for our hearing today, that the national certification for the nurse who wants to practice within a certain scope has to be endorsed by the National Professional Nursing Organization that describes scopes and standards and statements specific to the practice as a clinical nurse specialist. And then it lists the areas in which that can occur. So I think people get lost a little bit in thinking that these people are doing the same thing that a physician is doing and losing track of the fact, you know, I was thinking when Ms. Chesney was talking about all the various different rotations, nurses, don't forget, begin that in their undergraduate degree. They're already taking clinical experiences. They're already engaged in time in practice at the undergraduate degree. So it doesn't begin after college, the educational process, that does in some of the other professions. This one begins in the undergraduate process with lots of clinical rotations and then a master's that's tends to focus them on a narrower component, and then the advanced practice obligations that would give them prescriptive authority or other authority in other special professions.
Senator Benson.
Thank you. And just to follow up, I'm looking at, for example, under nurse midwife practice, they can interpret diagnostic studies and prescribe. So if they detected ovarian cancer, could they order some sort of diagnostic and I can't
further analysis.
Order for analysis, mm-hmm. bring it back, make the analysis themselves? At what point do they stop doing nursing and step into medicine, and how do we get comfortable that we're going to have good handoff and not scope creep?
Who would like to answer?
We have another
Senator
testifier.
My name
Please
is,
state
this
your
is
name.
A nurse midwife, so that's
okay.
great.
Please state your name for the record. And
it's Brielle Stoike, nurse midwife. And just to answer your question, we have to practice within our national scope of practice, and our national scope of practice does not allow us to interpret results about cancer and treat for cancer. We would know to consult with a physician.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So are there specific organizations? Because I'm not seeing specific organizations called out. I see National Professional Nursing Organizations. And I just, on my phone, Googled nurse midwives, and there seem to be several. And so who sets the scope of practice? Help me understand. Because we're handing over a lot of scope of practice authority to an external organization that may change scope without a legislative body being aware that scope has changed.
And can you state your name again? I'm sorry, I didn't get your last name.
Brielle Stoike.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, the American College of Nurse Midwives oversees this specific role, and each of the four roles before you have a national organization.
Senator Benson, is that?
Nothing further right okay. now. Thank you, Madam Chair.
If possible, I'd like to move to further testifiers since we still have additional, and then if there are key questions that you'd like to ask after that, we can go back to a testifier. I have Jacob Ricks on the list. Please introduce yourself. And.
My name is Jacob Ricks. I'm a certified registered nurse anesthetist. I work at Mayo Clinic Health System in Lake City. We're an 18-bed critical access hospital, and as such, we're reimbursed by Medicare for providing anesthesia services to the patients in our community. And as a critical access hospital, we make that care accessible for our patients. And Medicare and the Department of Health and Human Services recognize the financial burdens and medical risks that longer distances place upon rural patients. And because of that, Medicare provides certification and reimbursement to enhance the financial performance of rural hospitals and reduce hospital closures. This allows hospitals like mine and others across Minnesota to remain open. Yet current Minnesota law places an additional and, I think, unnecessary burden on hospitals like mine, and I'm talking about the restrictions on my ability to obtain and use prescriptive authority in the service of my patients. Since the opt-out that Minnesota enacted in 2002, CRNAs have had the ability to practice and bill for anesthesia without the supervision of a physician. And as it stands now, the current collaborative agreements don't make any sense with current practice within small hospitals. And I can give you an example. I am one of two CRNAs that provide anesthesia services at my small hospital. Between the two of us, we make up the entire anesthesia department. So we don't have any physician anesthesiologists at our facility. In addition to providing anesthesia during surgery, we also provide other important services throughout the hospital. We respond to emergency room calls to intubate patients. We assist with difficult IV starts. We provide pain services for obstetrical patients who are in labor. And my partner and I, between the two of us, are on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Our professional education, skills, and experience make us far more knowledgeable about anesthesia medications than many of the physicians that we have collaborative agreements with. And in my case, I have a collaborative agreement with a local family practice physician who has no specialty training in anesthesia. And while I'm grateful for that agreement, I imagine such agreements make many physicians uncomfortable because they haven't trained in anesthesia. Not only is this a disincentive, it's unnecessary. Allowing myself and other APRNs full prescriptive authority is not a radical change. It would simply acknowledge what, for all intents and purposes, is already the practice in Minnesota. By removing the burdensome and redundant collaborative agreement requirement, the legislature would increase long-term efficiency and effectiveness of the state's health care providers. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Ricks before we move on? Okay, so seeing none, let's move on to the testifiers in opposition. I have listed Dr. Will Nicholson and Dr. Julie Anderson. Are you present? And we can begin with Dr. Nicholson. Please state your name and your title for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Will Nicholson. I am a family physician. I practice at Healthy St. John's Hospital in Maplewood, Minnesota. And I'm here today to testify on behalf of the more than 10,000 physician members of the Minnesota Medical Association. As you know, the issues addressed in Senate File 511 are controversial, but I believe not unresolvable. Our state has consistently led the nation in health care for the simple reasons that our leaders are able to collaborate and they put the best interests of patients first. I believe we need to continue doing that into the future. Some would say that this bill would lead us to a turf battle, and you've seen a little bit of posturing over that in previous testimonies. I really believe that a turf battle would lose the best interests of our patients as its central tenet. Just as I am confident in the quality of the collaborative, multidisciplinary care that I depended on to take care of hospitalized patients this morning, I believe that we as a state and as healthcare providers can put politics aside in order to move forward in a constructive way. I appreciate all of you taking the time to consider the implications of this bill and to listen to the physicians' concerns as well as the nurses' concerns as we work together to move forward. I have three brief points that I'd like to consider, and then I'd be happy to take questions. Foremost, as I mentioned earlier, we have to put patients first. Regardless of the policy issues before you, The end product of this work must be a healthcare system that consistently delivers high-quality, affordable, well-coordinated care for all Minnesotans. I think we can all agree on that goal, and I'll be the first person to admit that we don't always deliver on that goal all the time. I unfortunately assume that some of you have had experiences with our healthcare system that would affirm that. We have a long ways to go, but I would argue that our efforts need to push forward altruistically and not get sidetracked by blame placing, self-promotion, or a biased review of the evidence available. Second, great care is a collaborative effort. Caring for patients is an increasingly complex activity in a world where science advances at an ever-quickening pace. No single independent provider, regardless of his or her skills, training, or good intentions, can meet all the needs of a patient. Great care requires a team. Our patients need us to work together, not against each other. Every recent innovation in healthcare delivery that has come up over the last few years, including healthcare homes, bundled payment models, shared savings programs, total cost of care arrangements, and accountable care organizations, all rely on more collaboration among healthcare professionals, not less. Yet, as the three speakers that will come after me and I believe, the bill before us will take our healthcare system in the opposite direction. Independence is what we want for our patients. Integration is what we need in a great care team. As we empower the unique skills of advanced practice nurses, who I depend on every day, we must commit to the necessity of collaboration and patient care. Third and finally, you've all heard the importance of allowing nurses to practice at the top of their license. I agree. Almost every doctor agrees. In primary care, we're practically begging for help. Great changes need to be made. We need to employ advanced practice nurses much more effectively. But at the same time, we have the obligation in healthcare to, above all, first do no harm. There will be those who will attempt to practice beyond their training expertise. And as leaders, it's up to you if you expand the scope of APRNs into areas that historically are the practice of medicine. You must ensure that APRNs are held to the same rigor of clinical training, maintenance of certification, and quality surveillance that physicians like me are held to. The bill before you does not accomplish this. The Minnesota Medical Association looks forward to continuing to work on these issues in a collaborative way. I appreciate your consideration, and as I said, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And now, Dr. Anderson, please state your name for the record as well.
Julie Anderson, Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senator Sheeran. I am Julie Anderson. I'm a family physician practicing in St. Cloud. I also service rural folks in Clearwater and Cold Spring area. I'm also the immediate past president of the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians. I practice in a clinic that has family physicians, nurses, advanced practice nurses, physician assistants, and we all work very closely to provide the best care we can to the patients we serve. I've had the opportunity to train many of the APNs and APRNs and PAs that serve our community and our clinic. I depend on all of these professionals to perform my work. We've heard from earlier testimony about the Institute of Medicine's report on the future of nursing and how that clearly makes the case for independent APRN practice. In fact, that report also talks about the importance of team-based care. To quote the IOM report directly, teams, quote, need to include patients and their families as well as a variety of health professionals, including nurses, physicians, pharmacists, physical and occupational therapists, among others. It goes on to add that nurse education must prepare, quote, prepare nursing graduates to work collaboratively and effectively with other health professionals in a complex and evolving healthcare system in a variety of settings. Another argument made in support of independent practice is that it would help reduce healthcare costs. The data on that is not conclusive. A Health Partners initiative implementing healthcare homes showed a decrease in patient wait times, an increase in optimal diabetes and cardiac care, fewer ER visits, and decreased costs of $1,200 per patient per year. The Minnesota Department of Health also released its evaluation just recently on healthcare homes that showed that clinics
that our healthcare homes outperform other clinics and reduce medical assistant costs by 9%. These studies show the value of a collaborative, team-based care. Also, the Agency of Healthcare Research and Quality, AHRQ, has demonstrated recently that in all primary care service areas, those with an APRN or PA to family physician ratio of about 1:1 have the lowest costs and fewer hospitalizations. Ratios above this, meaning that there are more APRNs or PAs to a family physician, were associated with substantially higher costs and utilization. We are on the cusp of some dramatic demographic shifts in both the aging of our population and the aging of many of our healthcare providers, particularly in rural areas where I practice. These shifts are likely to strain the capacity of some of our current healthcare resources, but that doesn't mean we should change our commitment to delivering high-quality care throughout the state. Rather, it means that we need to better leverage the talents that all healthcare professionals bring to the table. The MAFP is supportive of efforts to ease the administrative burdens and challenges in current law that inhibit appropriate APRN prescribing and practice. But I would suggest that the solution to our rural access problems is not APRNs practicing independently from physicians. As mentioned previously, there are substantial training and experience differences between physicians and APRN. And as mentioned earlier, we manage in primary care, family practice, more complex patients, especially in primary care. In fact, just last Thursday, I saw a patient with strep throat who I think based on my years of experience, I just knew something was wrong. And yes, I treated his strep throat, but I imaged his neck, and he had behind the strep a squamous cell carcinoma. So it doesn't always mean that just because it's an easy strep that it's an easy diagnosis. And I think based on that, that is where experience comes into play. It does not mean that one is less valued than the other. It just means we need to carefully define those boundaries for the benefit of our Minnesota patients. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. And like Dr. Nicholson, I'd be happy to answer questions if I can.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions for either of the two witnesses at the table? Senator Rosen.
I do have a question. I'm hearing a lot about this collaborative team-based care, and I'm just curious. We've seen in front of this committee many collaborative type of initiatives, and one of them is the community paramedic, Senator Sharon, which had a lot of pushback from nursing, actually, or from people that were somewhat in a turf war. You're not going to overstep my boundaries. And it's proven to be a huge success that's going nationwide, this bill that passed out of this very body and is a state law and now seeing great success. But anyway, I keep hearing this collaborative team-based care, and I'm just wondering what would you suggest this collaboration would be? I'm just hearing about the complaints, and I can't quite pin, and I'm listening very closely, what should this look like if this is not the bill, either Dr. Anderson or Dr. Nicholson?
I think you're hearing a lot about it because collaboration is the holy grail of healthcare in America. We have the best technology, the most training, and we put the most money into it, but we have a healthcare system that consists of a bunch of different silos of care that don't interact well and don't do things in a patient-centered way. They do things in a silo-centered way. So the pushback you get from us is when you talk about another, as you said, turf battle, it's one more silo that has the potential to get built. What the answer is, how we fix collaboration, that's a really complicated question. But, you know, I'd much rather be talking about that than talking about scope of practice right now. There are so many things that we could do to help address the issues that the APRNs have brought up in the course of this testimony. No one has worked harder to do that than family physicians. And, I'd love it if we focused on collaboration.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Nicholson, there's absolutely no doubt that there's the collaboration with the primary care physician, especially out in greater Minnesota, has got to be paramount. I mean, it has to work like that. You cannot work in your own silo. But the testimony, and I know that to be true with Mr. Ricks from Lake City as a critical care hospital and what his work is in that operating room, he's already collaborating with his physicians and doing the job that that we're talking about right now. So I can't get my hands around exactly what you want this bill to change. And if you could tell us exactly what you want this bill to look like, it sure would make our life easier, because I'm just getting this high level talk here, and it's not. And I'm sure this Senator Sharon is feeling the same thing. Is what exactly do you want?
Dr. Nicholson. You need to direct your conversation through the chair.
Please. Oh, I'm sorry. Madam Chair, I apologize. Senator Rosen, this is a lot different than the hospital. What we want is, as I mentioned, not another turf battle, but we want to not move towards independent practice for anyone else until we are absolutely sure that it is not going to fracture care, that it is not going to increase the cost of care, and it's not going to put our patients at risk. As I said, we need to first do no harm. So there are a lot of issues around independent practice that we can address easily, but independent practice is the thing that concerns most of the physicians in our organization. We would love to work better together. We're just not sure that there's evidence, that it's safe and that it's conclusively proven that the path forward that will solve these problems is independent practice. Does that
Senator
help?
Rosen. Senator Rosen, do you have further questions?
Madam Chair and Dr. Nicholson, I guess I'm not quite getting the answer that I was hoping for. Obviously, doing no harm or providing the care that is necessary is already being done by the APRNs and the CRNAs. And so I somewhat challenge you on the fact that you're saying do no harm, and I'm not seeing where they are providing the care that is absolutely necessary. There is a shortage. We have issues out there. And believe me, definitely want to keep the boundaries on such pain management, too. Senator Sharon and I have talked quite extensively on this, but I still don't understand what the solution is to your angst or the reason for you to come in front of this testifying table.
Are there any further questions that Senator Hayden?
I don't want to belabor the point, but I was just kind of picking up on Senator Rosen's point. And maybe this isn't the right time, Senator Sharon, but Dr. Nicholson, I guess what I'm trying to figure out, what would you propose, and maybe this is too long of an answer,
okay,
that from the Minnesota Medical Association, what are the kind of things that you would propose that would help us move this along? I heard a lot of what you're not for, but I was just, sometimes I want to know. I think it'd be helpful from your vantage point as a physician and representing the doctors. What would help? What would you propose that would help us move this along and have the continuity of care, patient-centered, patient safety, cost containment, all the things that we know that we have to do, and that I think that Senator Sharon is trying to get at? What would you do?
Dr. Nicholson.
Madam Chair and Senator Hayden, as I said, I don't think there's a silver bullet for this. You know, a great example is a patient-centered medical home, or the healthcare home, as it's been enacted in Minnesota. It allows an integrated healthcare team to work together based on not a legal definition or a scope of practice definition, but a team definition that allows each person to practice to the best of their ability to collaborate to improve care for patients. And we've got pretty good results that show that kind of collaboration doesn't need a change in scope of practice, doesn't need a legal action. What we need is
is the freedom to work creatively, rather than restricted by Medicare billing codes and other regulations, to put a team together that can actually do patient-centered care rather than billing-based care or care based on scope of practice. Does that help?
Yeah, well, Madam Chair, Dr. Nichols, I think it does. I mean, I think that part of the issue is that this does turn into, and we've been here, at least I have long enough, that it does seem to be turf battle. It does seem to be based on, you know, if I may, who, you know, training is really important, but I've been trained. I've taken all the time, all the steps to be here. Now here comes the next group. And not to pick on you, I think Senator Sharon talked about community paramedics. We've talked about dental hygienists and dentists, OT, PT, sports medicine. So I just sports massage. I just want to make sure that you don't know that I'm picking on you. But I think that often what happens is that whoever is on the next level of that perch is always the one that starts to feel a little insecure. And I don't want to demean the work that you do because you do phenomenal work and is trained for it. Starts to feel a little insecure that that person's encroaching upon their turf. So what I sometimes I think would be helpful even in the future as this moves along is to really have that group who feels like maybe the next group is infringing upon their turf, maybe rightfully so, maybe based on really strong data that says that we don't know if they're ready to approach. I think the doctor really made a great point about a strep throat and then there was something else really dangerous going on. But how does your group help us untrained, or at least from my perspective, I know we have a few nurses and others, but a person like me really start to help me understand how this should work as opposed to kind of why what they're proposing doesn't work. And so I know that's a longer conversation, but I think that that is helpful for the legislature to try to help make these kind of decisions as we move forward, as opposed to just what I've seen in the 6 years I've been here, which is just a really fight, a tug one way or the other.
Senator Sharon, did you want to say?
Well, I just wanted to remind the committee that there were a couple other testifiers right. that needed to testify, I think, now as right. opposed to later. So
I'd like to move on to the next testifiers, and I have listed Dr. David Schultz and Dr. Scott Nelson.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Dr. David Schultz. I'm medical director for MAPS Medical Pain Clinics. I'm a board-certified anesthesiologist, and I've been practicing interventional pain management in Minnesota for the past 25 years. So I've seen this field evolve over that period of time. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Society of Interventional Pain Physicians. My testimony today is regarding interventional pain management, which I'll call IPM for short, and why IPM should only be practiced by qualified physicians. Interventional pain management is a new and distinct medical specialty which involves the use of minimally invasive image-guided procedures to diagnose and treat chronic pain. But IPM is far more than putting needles into the body. It requires taking on the diagnosis and management of some of the most complicated and difficult and challenging patients in all of medicine. Chronic pain patients have typically failed routine medical management by their primary care physicians, and they've also failed specialty care by neurologists and surgeons before they arrive at the pain clinic. They present to the pain clinic with a variety of disabling and complex disease states, including chronic abdominal pain, intractable headache, multilevel spinal degeneration, whiplash injury, cancer pain in all of its forms, and chronic pain syndrome, complicated by chemical dependency and psychiatric illness. We're not talking about sore throats here. These are very difficult, complicated patients that require a doctor to deal with. As a medical specialty, interventional pain management has much in common with interventional cardiology. Whereas the cardiologist targets the cardiovascular system, the pain physician targets the peripheral and central nervous systems. Both medical specialties have a rapidly evolving scientific knowledge base and require extensive medical background and training to diagnose and treat disease states using high-tech procedures that carry a significant risk of fatal complications. Potential complications of pain procedures include life-threatening allergic reactions, spinal infection, including meningitis, spinal bleeding, nerve damage, spinal cord injury with paralysis, brainstem infarction, and death. Consider this example. In the field of cardiology, a non-physician provider may be able to master the placement of a cardiac stent, but that does not mean that that person should be allowed to function as a cardiologist. The same analogy applies to CRNAs who want to practice interventional pain management. CRNAs may well know how to place an epidural block for surgical anesthesia, but they do not have the medical background or training to practice medicine in the pain clinic. And interventional pain management is the essence of the practice of medicine. The pain physician must evaluate and synthesize history and physical examination data, advanced imaging studies, laboratory results, bone scans, electromyography, and the results of past medical care to come up with a differential diagnosis and medical and interventional treatment plan. The pain physician must stay abreast of rapidly advancing scientific research in order to provide the best evidence-based care for the medical care for the patient. While this is common to all medical practice, IPM is unique in that we use precise fluoroscopically guided invasive procedures to diagnose and treat the physical generators of pain. It takes medical judgment and training to understand which procedures to use, as well as when, how, and why to use them. With some of our interventional procedures, if our needles are as much as 1 millimeter off target, and if we misinterpret a dye pattern, we can severely injure or kill the patient. Do we really want non-physicians given license to practice independently in this high-risk and potentially dangerous medical specialty? Because of the complexities involved in the treatment of pain, IPM is now recognized as a distinct and separate medical specialty by the American Board of Medical Specialties. Pain physicians must complete 4 years of pre-medical education, graduate at the top of their classes, and get into medical school. Then they do 4 years of medical school, 4 years of residency in either anesthesiology, physical medicine and rehab, or neurology, and then 1 to 2 years of a pain fellowship before they can even apply for the pain boards. In medical school, doctors study anatomy, physiology, biochemistry, pharmacology, genetics, microbiology, immunology, and the pathology of disease states. In residency, doctors learn how to take care of patients in the real world of clinical medicine. These years spent in college, medical school, internship, residency, and fellowship training give pain physicians the medical and scientific background necessary to practice medicine in the pain clinic. IPM is the newest medical specialty, and it is evolving rapidly. In the past, many unqualified physicians were practicing in this field. As the specialty matures, we are seeing a trend toward increased credentialing of IPM doctors with requirements for pain fellowship training and board certification in pain management. In fact, the Anesthesiology Society has stated publicly that anesthesiologists, board certified anesthesiologists, are not qualified to practice IPM without additional training and board certification in the pain field. The ASA wisely realizes that IPM is a separate and distinct medical practice from operating room anesthesia, and that anesthesiologists do not have the training to practice IPM from their anesthesia residency. If anesthesiologists are not qualified to practice in this field, how can CRNAs be qualified to do so? We do not have a shortage of pain providers, and we certainly do not need to open this field to non-physicians. I'll conclude with a question. If we are going to allow advanced practice nurses to practice medicine in the new specialty of pain management, What would prevent them from practicing medicine in the specialties of cardiology, oncology, urology, or radiology? Madam Chair and members of the committee, I thank you for allowing me to testify today on Senate File 511, and I'm available for any questions.
Thank you. And Dr. Nelson, please introduce yourself.
Yes, Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to provide comments today on the proposed legislation regarding the advanced practice registered nurses. My name is Dr. Scott Nelson. I'm an anesthesiologist currently practicing in multiple settings in St. Paul here and on the east side of the Twin Cities. I believe that I have a unique perspective on this issue given my background and how I got to this point in my professional career. I grew up in southern Minnesota, small town St. James, and pursued a degree in nursing and graduated from Mankato State University, and then went on to pursue a career in nurse anesthesia. I became a certified registered nurse anesthetist after attending a master's degree level of training at an excellent school here in Minneapolis. Following my education, I went to Mankato and worked with a group that covered Mankato and 10 rural communities around Mankato. predominantly we would work in Mankato under the direction of and in collaboration with the anesthesiologists there. But occasionally, one day a week or so, we would go out to the small communities and provide anesthesia services in collaboration with the operating room surgeons there. After about 5 years of working in that arena, I wanted to increase my depth and breadth of knowledge, so I applied to medical school, was accepted, went to the University of Minnesota Medical School, and then went on to do an anesthesiology residency at Mayo Clinic, where I did 1 year of internal medicine and 3 years of anesthesiology. What happened to me over that time was I developed a distinct difference in my perspective. When I was a nurse anesthetist, I felt confident that I was well-trained, and I felt that I knew everything that there was to know about anesthesia, and I did a good job. When I went to medical school, I was alerted or I guess my change in perspective by how much I don't know. And now every day I practice medicine differently, where I am concerned with what I don't know rather than what I do know. With respect to the particular bill at issue, our most significant concern centers around the proposed elimination of the collaborative care model that is currently in place for anesthesia care delivery around the state. Currently, the vast majority of anesthesia delivery collectively around the state is done through the anesthesia care team model. This generally involves an anesthesiologist working with the nurse anesthetist and the operating room surgeon to develop the best course of action to ensure the health and safety of the patient following their surgical procedure. What I do is I medically evaluate the patient, I interview and examine them, and then decide in collaboration with the surgeon and the patient what the best route of anesthesia would be for them. We do recognize that there are many areas around the state where anesthesiologists are not present in the hospital setting. Having worked in several of these locations previously as a CRNA, I work directly with the operating room surgeon on the anesthesia plan for each patient. I strongly believe that the model of care of collaboration between doctors and nurse anesthetists is critical for every single patient that receives anesthesia across our state, no matter whether it's the most routine surgical procedure or the most complex. Every single time anesthesia is administered to a patient, there exists a possibility of significant irreparable harm or death to the patient. This is not an exaggeration, even though the patient's safety and anesthesia has improved significantly over the years that physicians have been involved. The collaboration model, whether that may be my collaborating with the other physicians and practitioners in the operating room suite, or a CRNA collaborating with the surgeon and other practitioners in the operating room suite, is the only way to ensure the safety of every single patient every single time. It's also important to address the issue of the potential cost savings that has been brought up in utilizing an anesthesiologist versus a CRNA. Under Medicare, no matter who is delivering the anesthesia, be that through the anesthesia care team model or a CRNA working in a smaller hospital around the state, the cost of anesthesia is the same. Finally, unlike some areas within primary care, there is simply not an access issue for anesthesia providers in Minnesota. Having worked in a number of settings in both rural areas and around the metro areas, Minnesota is fortunate to have access to a very large number of anesthesia providers in hospitals and ambulatory surgery centers across the state. We recognize that there are not anesthesiologists in many smaller hospitals around the state, but we believe that there are no barriers in placing preventing Minnesota patients from having proper access to anesthesia services in the state. In fact, we found that when we have the opportunity to bring an anesthesiologist to smaller communities, it actually increases the recruitment ability for specialty surgeons in that area, increasing access to specialty care. Thank you for your attention. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And we are very limited. We have about 5 minutes, and then we have to conclude our time in this room because there's another committee hearing. Does anybody have any quick questions for the people at the table right now?
Procedurally, Madam Chair, are you planning on having a vote on this before we leave, or
no,
are we going to carry this
no,
over?
No, the plan. I should state that. Excuse me. We will recess at that time until 6 o'clock, and we'll return to finish this bill, Senate File 511, and then we will take up Senate File 1792, which is the one that we passed over earlier. And then we will move to the agenda for the evening, which is Senate File 2027, which is the e-cigarette bill. So right now I'd like to finish, since we have these testifiers here, if there are quick questions for the two of them. But like I say, we cannot go more than about
4 or 5 minutes. Are there any questions? Senator Sharon.
Senator Wicklund, so let me just make certain that I understand. So we have some testifiers here. I'm hoping the committee asks them the questions that they need to now. And then we're going to be recessing and then picking this up immediately this evening for a further discussion between the committee members and the author. Is that correct?
Correct.
And then we'll move to the other components of the agenda.
That's correct. So, again, if you have a question that you feel needs to be answered by one of the testifiers at the table, it would be good to ask it now. All right. Seeing none, then we will recess until 6 p.m. Do I get it? And we will be in room 15 also. Thank you. 15. Still here.